Hi there, this is Darren Spoo, pastor at First Baptist Church in Tulsa, and welcome to our weekly podcast. For more information about First Baptist Tulsa, check us out on the web, tulsafbc.org. First Baptist Tulsa has a simple mission, to glorify God in all we do. We want to make God look good because He is good. May God bless you with His goodness this week.
Our scripture today comes from Revelation chapter 13. The dragon stood on the shore of the sea, and I saw a beast coming out of the sea. It had 10 horns and 7 heads with 10 crowns on its horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. The whole world was filled with wonder and followed the beast. People worshiped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast. And they also worshiped the beast and asked, "Who is like the beast? Who can wage war against it?" All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the Lamb's Book of Life, the Lamb who was slain from the creation of the world. Then I saw a second beast coming out of the earth. It had 2 horns like a lamb, but it spoke like a dragon. It exercised all the authority of the first beast on its behalf and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose fatal wound had been healed. It also forced all people, great and small, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hands or on their foreheads so that they could not buy or sell unless they had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the person who has insight calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. That number is 666.
As you can tell from Marissa's reading of the scripture this morning, this is not going to be a light Sunday. It's going to be a lot of heavy stuff. So I'm going to tell you what I told the first service. I'm going to push you as far as I think you can go, and then I'm going to push you a little further. And then once I've pushed you that far, I'm going to go ahead and push one more time and push you just a little bit further, because this is some really heavy stuff in the book of Revelation, but I also think it's some simple stuff to understand if we just allow our minds to be wrapped around what God is trying to tell us. So the book of Revelation is very challenging. It is very difficult to understand. But what I've given us is perhaps just a little bit of a framework by which to comprehend the book of Revelation, and most of it is just around this statement. If we could agree on this one thing, that the book of Revelation is a radical invitation to worship Jesus Christ and Him alone, that's it. And regardless of our different interpretations, if we can agree on that one thing, I think that we agree on more than what divides us, that come what may, you and I will worship Jesus Christ and Him alone. Furthermore, I've tried to give us a matrix of understanding Revelation, that Revelation from chapter 4 on to the end is just 7 visions. 7 visions. Each vision talks about eternity and the earth on which we live. 7 visions that exposes us to the reality of eternity and the reality of this place that we live here called earth. And these aren't 7 visions about 7 different things. They all expose the same reality, heaven and earth, different angles. And I've got to do this one more time because this is my favorite illustration. How many of you had the World Book Encyclopedia growing up? All the smart people, let me see your hands. There you go. I love the S volume because Santa Claus was in that one. And I love the H volume because it had the most pictures. And it had the picture of the human body and these little visqueen layovers, I guess is what they are. And they show, yeah, visqueen's a real word, I just made it up, so I don't know what these things are, but it shows the human body in different layers and different segments, and this really is my best understanding of the book of Revelation, that these 7 visions lay on top of one another and show us different angles of appreciating eternity and appreciating the earth on which we live. So the first vision was the vision of the 7 seals. We looked at that quite in depth. Then the second vision we skipped over, it's the vision of the 7 trumpets. We skipped over that one. Now we're on the 3rd vision now of the woman and the child and the dragon. And if you weren't here last week, I will catch you up to speed on that just really quick. But this is the framework that these 7 visions lay over one another to expose us to all the levels of reality of heaven and earth. So here's the question I want us to deal with today. And honestly, I could not have asked for better timing on this. I didn't plan it, but it's perfect timing. Here's the question we're going to deal with today. What is to be the Christian's attitude? What is to be the Christian's relationship with the state, with secular government, with secular authority, with the state, as followers of Jesus? What is to be our attitude and our behavior toward the state? Really, with a major election coming up, I couldn't have planned this any better. What is to be our attitude and our relationship with the secular government? I had a conversation, and I'll call it for what it was. It was a confrontation about a dozen years ago about a person who was very patriotic and wanted to see more patriotism in our worship services, and we were discussing that in quite an animated way. And he said, "I will not worship in a church that does not have an American flag in it." Now, I got what he was saying because he had served our country. He was very patriotic and very proud of that. But on another level, what he said to me disturbed me just a little bit, because I thought to myself, you better never go to Cuba and worship, because there won't be an American flag there. You better never go to any of the mission points that we have around the globe and worship there, because there won't be an American flag there. What is to be our relationship with the secular government? What is to be our relationship as we are citizens of the United States, most of us, and also citizens of the kingdom of God? How do those two work together? Well, the Bible's answer to that is your relationship with the civil government depends. It depends on what the civil government does. If the civil government is acting within its God-given boundaries, if it is acting as the authority God has intended it to be, then we are to absolutely respect civil authority. In fact, two references I want to give you here. Romans chapter 13, verse 6 and 7, it says, the government has been given to you as a servant of God. And so give what you ought to give. If taxes, then pay taxes. If revenue, then pay revenue. If respect, then give respect. So the secular government, when it operates within its normal God-given bounds, is a servant of God. But if the secular government oversteps those bounds, if the secular government begins to act and ask for a level of loyalty that is reserved only to God, then the secular government is no longer a servant of God. It actually becomes an agent of the devil. So now, for what us today is a hypothetical, okay? The government acts within its bounds. It's a servant of God. If it oversteps those bounds, it becomes a servant of Satan. What for us is a hypothetical question, in first century Christianity, this was a real issue, because first century Christianity, the Christianity where Christianity was born, the Christianity of John when he wrote Revelation, Christianity was on a collision course with the Roman government. Now, here's why. When you become a Christian, you give a very simple confession. It is simple, but it is profound. Here's the confession. We even use it here today. Jesus is Lord. I belong to Him. Okay? That's the confession of a Christian. I have only one Lord of my life, and He's Jesus Christ. It's a radical invitation to worship Jesus Christ and Him alone. But to be a good Roman citizen in the first century, in the time when Revelation was written, every Roman citizen had to go present themselves at a pagan temple or at a civic building, burn a little incense, and say these words, "Caesar is Lord." So what do you do? Now, Jews were exempted from this because the Romans knew that Jews had sensitivity to worship any god other than the one God, and so Jews were exempted from it. But as Christianity came out from under the Jewish umbrella, as it began to develop its own identity, they were not exempt. So this presented a real challenge for first century Christians. What do I do? Do I cross my fingers behind my back and say, "Caesar's Lord"? I'm just kidding. Do the convenient thing? Or do I really hold by my convictions that I will only call one person in life my Lord, and that is Jesus Christ, and stand by those convictions? It created a real problem for first century Christianity and first century Christians to know how, as followers of Jesus, to relate to secular government. So in the book of Revelation, two images are used to describe Rome. Okay, two images are used to kind of capture and sum up the Roman Empire. Now first, so I kind of feel you fading on me here a little bit, we're going to play a game. What I'm going to do is, you're allowed to talk out loud in church right now, not to each other, just to me, okay? Don't get carried away with this. I'm going to give you the symbolic name of a city, and then I want you to just say out loud what city I'm talking about, okay? So, for example, I say the Big Easy. What is that? New Orleans. Sin City. Some of you said Vegas, baby. That worries me just a little bit there. Las Vegas is the answer you're looking for. The Big Apple. New York. That's easy. City of Angels. Los Angeles. This is a tough one. This is an international city. City of Light. Paris. You're very good. Now, here's the last one. This is a tough one. The Big Toe. Toronto. I am not making that up. It is called The Big Toe is Toronto. I'm not making that up. That's real, all right? So in the book of Revelation, you go look it up. Don't ever doubt your pastor. I only tell you the absolute truth up here. I feel like you don't believe me. Don't look it up now. You can look it up later. So in the book of Revelation, there's two symbols. There are two nicknames that are given to Rome. One you'll run across in Revelation 18, Babylon. Now, why was it called Babylon? Because back in Hebrew history, 600 years before Jesus, the Babylonian Empire came in and tried to wipe Israel off the map, destroyed Jerusalem, and took all the best and the brightest people off in exile. And they were exiled in Babylon. So Rome was the new Babylon. We are still in exile. We might be at home in Israel, but a foreign government has control of us. So it's that picture of being in exile. But here's the other picture of Rome that I want you to capture today. What Revelation, what John, what Jesus calls Rome, the beast. Here is a beast, a juggernaut to be dealt with. Okay. So now I'm going to back up because we're in that third vision. If you weren't here last week, I'm going to catch you up real quick. Beginning of Revelation 12, there's a woman about to give birth. This is the nation of Israel, and her job is to birth the Messiah, this child. But all is not well, because as this child is born, there's a dragon, the devil, sent to devour the child, sent to destroy Jesus. And when the dragon could not destroy the child, when Satan could not destroy Jesus by death, he was enraged. And here's the last thing we left off with last week. And the dragon went off to wage war against her other offspring. Who's that? Us. We are the other followers of God. So if Satan can't get to Jesus, he's going to go after us. How is he going to do that? We're about to read, and we're going to read some things that Marissa read to us a minute ago. Satan is willing to give his power away to the beast in order to cause Christians to compromise. So, let's look here. Here's Revelation chapter 13. The dragon stood on the shore of the sea, and I saw a beast coming out of the sea. It had 10 horns and 7 heads. Now, that right there is very significant. Rome was a city built on 7 hills. And these crowns are the Caesars, okay? Everyone in the ancient world would go, oh, that's Rome. 10 crowns on its horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. What's that blasphemous name? Caesar is Lord. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority, and people worshiped the dragon because he had given the authority to the beast. And they also worshiped the beast and asked, who is like the beast? Who can wage war against it? Rome is mighty. It's been given power to wage war against God's holy people and to conquer them. And it was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all those whose names have not been written in the Lamb's Book of Life, the Lamb who was slain from the creation of the world. It brings back that simple choice. Do you say Jesus is Lord or Caesar is Lord? So what is this first beast? It's Roman political power. The political power that Satan has given Rome, that's overstepped its God-given authority, that has asked for a loyalty that is due only to Jesus Christ alone, the beast to cause Christians to compromise. Now, I have said from the very beginning that I believe everything in the book of Revelation has already happened, is happening, and will continue to happen until Jesus Christ returns. Rome has faded from the scene. But you need to know that for 300 years, Rome persecuted Christians until it finally became legal in 325 to be a Christian. And their political power tried to squelch Christianity. That has happened in the past. You know what? It still happens today. We have seen in our lifetime or in our recent history, governments that have overstepped their boundaries and have hurt people and have hurt Christianity. Think about Nazi Germany, the deification of a nation or national pride, and what kind of havoc that wreaked, especially on the church. Kosuke Koyama, who's a wonderful Japanese theologian, he said, look what emperor worship did to Japan in the 1930s. Emperor worship caused this nation to damage most of Asia and damage many parts of the world. It has happened. It is happening. It will continue to happen. Now, you and I don't experience that much because we live in the American bubble. But let me ask you this question. Would you be willing to be labeled a bad American if it meant that you would be a committed Christian? If you had to make a choice between being a committed Christian, even if it makes you, by some people's evaluation, a bad American, what would you do? Would you compromise your citizenship, or would you compromise your Christianity? I say this because it's a hypothetical right now, but we don't know how long that will be hypothetical. Would you be a committed Christian even if it meant that you'd be labeled as a bad American? No one has written more profoundly or clearly on this than a man named Andy Crouch. Andy Crouch has written a book called Culture Making, and in it, he says Christians should have four responses to culture around us, okay? And all four of these responses are valid, okay? One is we should not be afraid to consume culture, okay? Most of us here in this room, we are Americans. We live in the American culture. Let's consume those parts of our culture that are morally neutral. Thank God for coffee houses. I love coffee houses. They are morally neutral, okay? I love going to Starbucks. I love going to Topeka. I love going to Double Shot. That's a part of the culture in which we live, and we can consume that guilt-free. There are other parts of our culture that even we can copy. Do you know that most church architecture is a copy of pagan architecture? And even today, churches model themselves after what's going on in the rest of society. Churches are being built as warehouse space, as storefront space, as looks like office space. It's just copying culture. We do the same with our music, okay? You say, well, that's why I attend this service. We don't copy culture in this service. Did you just hear the drums? I love that, all right? That's a musical form that comes out of culture that we copy, okay? And we can use it to glorify God. But there are some parts of culture that we don't need to consume, we don't need to copy. We need to be critical about some parts of culture. Now, I don't mean negative. I mean, we need to use our mental faculties. If you're a follower of Jesus, you should be very critical about your use of social media. Why? Because people use social media as an avenue to be angry at everyone and anyone. And if you vent your spleen on Twitter or Facebook, that is not flattering to Christ. In fact, some people even have other accounts set up where they're anonymous and they can say whatever they want to. If that is you, delete that account tomorrow because that is not a reflection of integrity. We should be critical of our use of these things. But then, there's some parts of culture that we outright condemn. There is nothing redeeming about pornography. There is nothing redeeming about abortion. There is nothing redeeming about sex trafficking. These are things in our culture that we should outright condemn as followers of Christ. So here's the one I want to hit you with here. I want you to think in terms of how our culture defines being a Christian. Here's the cultural expectation of being a Christian. Okay, believe whatever you want. Have enough faith to get you accepted into heaven, but don't have the kind of faith that really affects your day-to-day life. Don't bring it to the office. Don't bring it to work. Don't have enough to get you accepted into heaven, but not so much as it really affects your daily life and might make other people around you a little uncomfortable. That's the cultural sell of what a Christian ought to be. Listen, either your faith means everything to you, or it is worth nothing. Either your faith means everything to you, and it has a free pass into any area of your life, or really it's worth nothing. That cultural definition of being a Christian is something that we should condemn. So, this has happened. Political pressure. It has happened. It is happening. It will continue to happen. That Satan is willing to give away some of his power to political forces to cause Christians like you and me to compromise. Now, I think I've pushed you just about as far as you can go, so I'm going to push you a little bit further. That's just the first beast. There's another beast. She has a twin sister, all right? Here's the next one. Then I saw a second beast coming out of the earth, and it had two horns like a lamb, but it spoke like a dragon. It exercised all the authority of the first beast on its behalf and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose fatal wound had been healed. It also forced all people, great and small, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive the mark on their right hands or their foreheads so that they could not buy or sell unless they had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of its name. What is this second beast? So we have the dragon. He gives his power to Roman political power, that it can be political power in any era. So what's this second beast? And to sum it up, I will just quote from the famous election 1988 between Clinton and Bush. It's the economy, stupid. This is Roman economic power. You see, if you didn't sacrifice incense and say Caesar is Lord, you might not be able to have a job. Your home, your possessions, your family could be taken away from you. This was economic pressure to force and to enforce spiritual compromise. You won't be able to buy or sell unless you have the mark of the beast. Okay, it's the economic pressure put on Christians. So I want you to listen to G. Morgan Campbell very carefully at this point, because again, as Christians, we live in a bubble. We are perhaps the most affluent people in the history of the world as Western Christians. G. Campbell Morgan says this: Satan's second favorite temptation is economic deprivation, to deprive you of your stuff. He said Satan's first favorite temptation is economic affluence. His second favorite temptation is to take away your stuff. His favorite temptation is to give you everything your heart desires. And G. Campbell Morgan goes on to say, we have become such a consumeristic culture that we are so busy accumulating things that we have forgotten that we are in a spiritual battle. It's not that Satan threatens to take away our stuff. He has deadened us because we live in an overly consumer-driven culture. We spend all of our time keeping up our appearances, making sure that we buy things we don't want with money we don't have to impress people we don't like. I love that phrase. That we have forgotten that we're in a spiritual battle. So I had a good friend years ago who was very affluent, a very fluent member in this community. And over lunch one day, he said, don't condemn rich people and then turn around and ask them for money for your church. And I said, that's a great point. Kind of coach me on that a little bit. Give me your life experience. He said, speak directly to it. We do have a lot of stuff in our culture, but then teach us how to overcome that. Here's what you do. And just about everyone in this room, even if you live just a little bit above poverty, you are still, hard to imagine this, one of the richest people in the world. Okay, listen, we overcome this economic pressure to conform by living simply and being generous. I'm going to push you as far as you can go today. Our culture says, don't worry about what you make. Live beyond what you make. That's why we have credit cards. For the Christ follower, we don't live beyond what we make or even with what we make. We live within less of what we make so that we can practice the second thing, generosity. There is nothing that will battle the beast of economic and consumeristic pressures like being generous. So what I'm about to tell you, I'm going to tell you I'm very uncomfortable saying this. I'm not comfortable talking about money. But this is where my personal taste trumps what I want to say as a pastor. Okay? You should expect that I tithe here to the church. If I don't, we're all in trouble, right? So I tithe. This year, I signed a book contract. And for the first time in a long time, we had some extra money just to dream and say, how do we want to give some of this stuff away? It's not just about us getting it. It's now what can we do? And so my wife and I prayed very deliberately, and we said we want to give to two things that we're passionate about. We want to give to the children's building, that we want to go above and beyond what we were giving, and we want to give more to the children's building because we see that as a tool that God is going to use in the future. And we went and gave a gift back to our Baptist student ministries from our college hometown where we met, where we were both discipled, where we were given that gift. We wanted to give it to other students. And I'm saying all this to tell you this. It was a rush of pleasure to be able to give away. Some of you here today, you're spending all your money on yourself and you're miserable. If you want to experience joy, practice generosity. I'm going to take it up a notch. If you are not giving to God's work somewhere, you are sinning against Him with your outright selfishness. I'm not saying that so you'll give to the church. I'm saying that so you'll give somewhere. Now, I don't want to be guilty for not asking. If you're not giving anywhere, might I suggest, there are a few things this church is going to do in this decade that are as important as this children's building, that we are creating a tool for decades of children to come into. If you want a place to practice generosity, that's it. So do you see, the book of Revelation, Satan is trying to get to us. He'll use political pressure. He'll use economic pressure. Will you compromise? Will you sell out? Or will you be a committed Christ follower come what may? All right, I've pushed you as far as you can go. Now I'm going to take it one step further. I got a chuckle in the first service. I got something. Maybe y'all are ready to go. I don't know. Here's the last thing. Probably you've been waiting to get to this. This calls for wisdom. Let the person who has insight calculate the number of the beast, for it's the number of a man. And that number is 666. Now, because of this, Christians are afraid of the number 666. About a year ago, I went to Five Guys Burgers. I love Five Guys Burgers. I would marry Ron's, but I'll date Five Guys, all right? That sounded weird. I'll never say that again. Got our order. My order number was 66 on my ticket. Thought, oh, if I were afraid of 666, I would reject this order. No, I ate it, and it was fantastic, okay? I have no fear of this number. Hebrews played with numbers. Jews played with numbers the way we play with names. We take names and we reshuffle the letters. It's called anagrams. We reshuffle the letters. Clint Eastwood, if you reshuffle the letters in his name, it spells action, Western action hero. All right. If you take Osama bin Laden, reshuffle the names, really bad man, no joke. Okay. If you take the word mother-in-law, reshuffle the letters, it is woman Hitler. Woman Hitler. I'm not making that up either. It's good stuff. So Hebrews, Jews, played with names and numbers the way that we do. It's called gematria. So if you were to take my name Darren D would be the fourth letter in the Hebrew alphabet, so that would be four. And they would add up the letters of a name. So it's very clear to first century Hebrew Christians or first century Christians. 666 was the number of a man, Nero Caesar. Now, by the time this was written, Nero Caesar had already come onto the stage of history and had left. Why would this be pointing to a person who, even for the writer of Revelation, was already history? Because Nero Caesar embodied what was worst about Roman government: the political and economic pressure. And not only that, persecution, outright unashamed persecution of Christianity. And guess what? His spirit still lives on today. The name might have changed, but that pressure is still on each of us. Political pressure and economic pressure. Will you be conformed or will you be committed to Christ? So, is it wrong to have an American flag in the worship center? Absolutely not. As long as the flag knows its place. Because what belongs at the center of a worship center is a cross. Can I tell you that I cringe every time I see a flag draping a cross? Because whenever you drape a flag over a cross, you cover up the cross. Let us not forget where our true and only commitment lies, and that is to Jesus Christ, and we worship Him alone.